Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. It's been 2 years since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, or maybe I should say its latest invasion of Ukraine, and things are not going great. Russia has been making gains on the battlefield. Ukrainian soldiers are said to be rationing ammunition, and the government there for the first time acknowledged more than 31,000 troops have been killed in action. Meanwhile, in Russia, dissident Alexei Navalny was the latest critic of President Vladimir Putin to die under mysterious circumstances. Americans continue to be arrested by the Russian government on trumped-up charges. And it turns out a Russian spy, an alleged Russian spy, might be responsible for helping congressional Republicans work to try to impeach President Biden. In this challenging environment, we've occasionally checked in with Ian Kelly, the ambassador in residence at Northwestern University. He began his career in the U.S. Foreign Service in the last years of the Soviet Union. He held a variety of high-level roles in the U.S. State Department and served as the department's spokesman under then-Secretary Hillary Clinton. From 2010 to 2013, he was U.S. Representative to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe and finally served as ambassador to Georgia, another former Soviet state that has been targeted by Russia. Ambassador Kelly, always good to talk with you. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Brian. Happy to be back.
And listeners, you can always join us at 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. As we are going to air this Thursday morning, President Vladimir Putin has been giving his annual address to the nation. I guess it's kind of like a State of the Union thing. He's threatening the West with nuclear conflict is one of the headlines coming out of that. But I actually want to begin our conversation some time ago in the past. And I wonder if you can just talk briefly about where you were, what you were doing December 25th, 1991.
Boy, I really remember that very well. I had just come off of a tour in Moscow. We left in late 89, and I was in another country that was sort of collapsing from within. I was in Yugoslavia. And I really, since I was a child of the Cold War, I so wanted to fly to Moscow just to be in Red Square at midnight and watch the Soviet flag come down and the traditional tricolor Russian flag, watch it go up. Since it was Christmas Day, I think my reason prevailed. You know, I had a family with two small children. Of course, I wasn't going to be gone for Christmas Day, but it was a momentous day for those of us who spent time in the Soviet Union, as I did, twice as a student and once as a diplomat. To see that flag come down was just awesome. It was one of the great days of my professional life, I have to say.
So from that moment, since we're talking about the late 80s, early 90s, let's say I had a time machine, maybe a DeLorean. I show up, I say I'm from the future. I tell you everything that's happened in the last three decades. Russia is still killing dissidents. It's arresting Americans. It's invading its neighbors. And that one of America's major political parties would be in thrall to the Russian government, seemingly. I wonder what Ian Kelly, 1991, would have made of where we are today.
Well, I think if you told me that the one of the two major parties was listening to a front or a vessel for the, you know, what is the equivalent of the KGB to impeach the president of the United States, I would say, was this invasion of the body snatchers or something? I mean, this party was the party of Reagan, who stood up against aggressors, who stood up against leaders who would imprison and kill dissidents. It is just, it is really, you know, to use a Seinfeld reference, perhaps, rather than a cinematic reference, it's really kind of bizarro world, how everything has really kind of changed 180 degrees. Again, it is just very, very hard for this old cold war horse to believe that the Republican Party has started to listen to the other side.
Yeah. Well, maybe we can come back to that because I'm not sure that that story's gotten enough attention in America, but there's some other things I do want to talk about. And obviously a lot of American attention has been directed to the death or the murder, you say it how you want to say it, of Alexei Navalny. He died in a prison in Siberia. He was in prison because of, I think it's fair to say, his opposition to Vladimir Putin. What did you think of him? And I guess more broadly, the question I have in mind is, what are the prospects of democratic liberalization in Russia?
Yeah, well, I think really it didn't just start with Navalny. It really started with a politician named Boris Nemtsov, who was also murdered, really right, you know, just 100 yards from the Kremlin, gunned down. And he was the most gifted politician of his generation, was actually a vice prime minister under Yeltsin. And the democratic forces in Russia in the 90s were really hoping that Yeltsin would pick him to succeed him. He unfortunately went the other way with Vladimir Putin. So Putin has really murdered the two best hopes for democracy, the two most talented democratic-minded politicians, Boris Nemtsov and Alexei Navalny. So it is just, it's really a crushing blow. Both were really outstanding leaders. Navalny in particular knew how to use 21st century technology to reach millions of Russians through his YouTube channel, using, not only strong evidence against the corruption of the Putin regime, but also using humor too, which is something that that Russians have not seen really in their leaders for gosh centuries. So it really it doesn't bode well in the short term for the future of democracy in Russia. I'd like to think, though, that in the long term, Putin once again showed his brutal instincts, and that Russians will eventually, I think, will come around. It's just that this is in the short term. It's a huge blow to lose a leader like Navalny.
Well, as Navalny was dying under mysterious circumstances in a Russian prison, in Russian jails, there are still multiple Americans who continue to suffer on arguably trumped up charges, right? There's Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovitz. There are two women with dual U.S.-Russian citizenship. One's a journalist, Kermasheva. There's we've just learned recently that a beautician and ballet dancer from Los Angeles called Karolina was charged with treason, apparently for sending $51.80 to a Ukrainian relief organization. She was arrested when she went home to visit family. And then there's American businessman Paul Whelan, who reportedly could have been freed years ago for in exchange for the arms dealer Viktor Bout. But we learned that then President Trump wouldn't agree to that. So Russia arrested women's basketball star Brittany Griner and traded her for Bout instead. Whelan remains locked up. Why does Russia keep arresting Americans or dual citizens?
Yeah, unfortunately, I guess the short answer is that because they can. I think that this is all part of their overall strategy to try and keep Washington and the Biden administration on their back feet, to try to distract their attention from the real issue, which of course is the brutalization of one of the largest countries in Europe, Ukraine. And also it's a KGB tactic. It happened plenty of times in the Soviet Union, where the Soviets would arrest if we had somebody that they wanted, that we'd arrested, who didn't have diplomatic immunity, they would turn around and they would arrest a journalist or a scholar and do this kind of asymmetrical trade to get somebody that they have. that they want from us. The problem, I think, is that right now we don't really have anybody that they want. I think you've probably seen the news reports that there was a kind of a three-way deal in the works with Germany, who's holding clearly an FSB hitman, gunned down a dissident, Chechen dissident in the streets of Berlin. And that would have included Navalny and a couple of the people you mentioned, Gershkovitz and Whelan, but that fell apart. Navalny's people think it fell apart precisely because Putin did not want Navalny to be able to carry on with this very effective use of social media to encourage opposition to Putin. And he just hated Navalny. You know, he never once ever publicly called him by his name. He hated Navalny that much.
And apparently people have even been arrested trying to leave flowers in memory to him around Russia.
I know.
Sites.
Yeah. It's just extraordinary. And Brian, you know, in that regard, I don't know if you've also heard that they have prevented the family from renting even a hearse for the funeral of Navalny. Or any kind of venue where people can pay tribute to him in a public way. So even after death, they're still making things difficult for Navalny and his family.
And yet, there's one American who was recently in, and as we've been talking about that aspect of this, there's one American who was recently in Russia who did not face arrest and actually got to spend time with Putin, and that is the former Fox News host, Tucker Carlson. I've seen a lot of resurgence of the phrase useful idiot, which I've learned is maybe falsely attributed to Lenin, but you can talk. Take that where you will. What do you make of this?
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, I said I'm an old Cold Warrior, but Cold War horse. But I remember that the leftist politicians or people who supported socialism back in the day would go to Moscow and crow about how great it was under socialism. Now we have people on the far right who are going to Moscow and showing how great things are under one man rule, authoritarian rule. So it's like everything is sort of changed 180 degrees. Left is right and right is left. It's just, you know, that was just all a part of, you know, Putin trying to get his message out to the right wing of the Republican Party to not support Ukraine, to not spend another dime on Ukraine. And unfortunately, it seems to be having some kind of effect in the House of Representatives with the Speaker. It's really distressing to see.
Well, you mentioned Putin getting his message out, and we have to take a break in about 2 minutes, but just this morning, I guess American time, he's giving his sort of annual speech to the nation. I'm looking at a New York Times translation here. He says that NATO countries that were helping Ukraine strike Russian territory or considering sending their own troops must understand that, quote, all this truly threatens a conflict with the use of nuclear weapons and therefore the destruction of civilization. I mean, we're back with the madman theory of deterrence, I guess, right?
Yeah, exactly.
What do you make of this?
Yeah, I mean, this is nothing new, in the sense that he's had other members of his government who've made these kinds of threats, including the only former Russian president of the 21st century, Dmitry Medvedev, is. Multiple times threatened to use nuclear weapons against the West. This might be the first time Putin has done it. And I, you know, I see this as a way to try to get, again, try to get the West to deter itself by not helping Ukraine. It's a sign of weakness, not strength, when he has to kind of rattle his ultimate weapon. I mean, even the Soviets didn't do that. They understood the significance of threatening nuclear annihilation, and they would not use it publicly. They might use it in diplomatic engagements, but not on a big public event like this. The annual State of the Union, basically, is what it was.
Yeah. You know, the metaphor of Chekhov's gun on the table is that it's a subtle reminder of what's coming.
Much less subtle than Chekhov.
Yeah, exactly. All right. We need to take a break. We will continue with Ian Kelly when we come back. This is the 21st Show. Please stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are beginning our program today with Ambassador in Residence at Northwestern University, Ian Kelly. He's a former high-level U.S. State Department official, and we've checked in with him repeatedly throughout the past couple of years, and it has been 2 years since Russia's latest invasion of Ukraine. And let's talk about that now. There have been a lot of headlines about Ukraine experiencing setbacks. A major city fell to the Russians, fears of hundreds of troops captured or missing in the retreat there. What are you seeing when you assess the present situation?
Yeah, I think if you look at the, let's call it the tactical level, you can see that that Russia is making sort of incremental advances, capturing villages while Ukraine goes more into, their forces go into more of a defensive mode after a year of being on the offensive. But I think if you look at it from a broader perspective, I think that Ukraine in many ways is winning, or you can say that the West is winning, which I think is just as annoying to Putin. If you look at the fact that Sweden just joined the alliance, and with Sweden and Finland joining the alliance, you basically have made the Baltic Sea, which is of course where Russia has its main warm water ports outside of the Black Sea. So it's basically a NATO lake now. So in many ways, Russia has taken many steps backwards because of this very brutal war. They've lost, depending on which analyst you listen to, a half or two thirds of the armor that they've had. They've lost tens of thousands of young Russian lives, and many more in casualties. I think most analysts will agree they've lost much more in terms of troops than Ukraine has. So I would not say necessarily that the momentum has really swung over to Russia, because as I say, the advances they've made have been very small. A few villages in the Donbas region. But it is true that Ukraine has to ration its ammunition, which is a terrible shame, because of the uncertainty that our Congress is creating in terms of Western military assistance, particularly ammunition and the kind of replacement missiles they need to protect their civilian anti-missile ammunition that they need to protect their civilian population.
Yeah, our Congress, and not to sound partisan about it, but really some number of congressional Republicans who have continued to refuse to support Ukraine financially. And all this seems to be related to former President Trump's unique pathology when it comes to Russia and Ukraine, which is beginning to bring us full circle to where we began this conversation and the sort of 180-degree flip we've seen in American politics on that. But in your view, what is at stake for America, for Americans, if we continue to refuse this financial support for Ukraine?
Well, I think that, again, taking a kind of a broader view, I think that the biggest threat would be to the most successful security community or defensive alliance in history, NATO, which provides a strong link across the Atlantic with the U.S. and Canada linked up, arm in arm. When it comes to mutual security with Europe. And Europe has stepped forward recently, mostly with economic assistance, but it really, because of our superior capabilities, defense capabilities, Ukraine needs our military assistance. And for us not to match what our European allies are doing, is really just a huge blow against that transatlantic alliance. And then I think, the other is the idea that we would allow a major European power to, at a minimum, change the borders of a sovereign European country, and at a maximum, even take over a European country, would, I think, really send a very dangerous signal to other expansionist powers. And you know who those expansionist powers are in South Asia, and then of course in East Asia. So I think the majority of Republicans in Congress recognize this danger and are willing to vote for this. It's a matter of the speaker putting it on the floor. And it will happen, but it's going to do damage to our reputation along the way.
Well, in the time we have remaining, speaking of the speaker and the some number of congressional Republicans, I do want to come back to this alleged Russian spy. Maybe I'm overstating it. Please correct me if I'm wrong. But Alexander Smirnov, he's got the name like the vodka. And I'm going to spend a little time going through this because I don't think this has gotten a great deal of attention, or maybe not as much as I think it should. This man has been charged with spreading false information about Hunter Biden and President Biden. This was one of the main pillars of the congressional Republicans' impeachment case against President Biden, the so-called Biden crime family, all that stuff you hear. And it was essentially, it seems, allegedly, the Justice Department alleges, a Russian disinformation operation. I mean, I don't want to be dramatic, but are we seeing a foreign government succeeding in hacking into American politics in a way that, past generations of foreign powers could only have dreamed of? Am I overstating this?
Yeah, well, it certainly has all the appearances of it. It certainly has all the appearances of a classic KGB operation, using a cutout to deliver the kind of destabilizing information that this represents. The idea that the President of the United States took a multi-million-dollar bribe from a foreign power. I'm sure that they were just rubbing their hands in glee when they heard that this guy was the main witness against the president. So it is, I don't think you're being overly dramatic with this. This is really a big deal. I think a lot more information has to come out, but it has all the appearances of an FSB, the successor agency to the KGB, of an FSB operation.
And I think there have been so much sort of memory holding of the Russian interference in American politics in the last decade. And it's not, maybe the wildest, progressive fever dreams of Trump getting orders directly from Putin or nonsense like that. But I mean, Russia did hack the Clinton campaign emails and time the release to blunt the effect of that campaign, right? The same day as the Access Hollywood tape came out. And they even hacked into the servers of the Illinois State Board of Elections right here in Springfield, although that didn't really seem to produce any results for them. But I mean, what should we be doing to protect America and ourselves mentally against more interference in our politics.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you, Brian. I don't think that Donald Trump is an active FSB agent. I don't think Speaker Johnson is an active FSB agent, but they certainly are, I think, a little too willing to hear the kind of evidence that supports their political case. And I think that to protect ourselves, I think that there has to be a heck of a lot more vetting of sources. As you say, the very name of this source, Smirnoff, should have caused them to go right away to the FBI and, you know, have this guy thoroughly vetted. I think that is that's the step that wasn't made here and has to be made. And it's in the political interest, I think, of the Republican Party to cooperate with the administration's law enforcement, especially with the FBI. And I don't think it happened because of the distrust of many in the Republican Party of the administration.
Well, it's always interesting speaking with you about these topics. Ian Kelly, Ambassador in Residence at Northwestern University. Thanks again, and I hope we can have you back on the program in the future.
Sure thing. Yeah, always a pleasure. Thanks very much.